You know, the nuance of crocheting a very realistic tree is extremely understated.
And the fact that they could just do it and put it right there into...
We interrupt this podcast with breaking news. A rift opened during Timmy Gunderson's 14th birthday at Chuck E. Cheese, and now possessed animatronic creatures are ravaging the city. Homelander and the rest of the Seven are nowhere to be found. Wait, what's that flying towards us? Homelander? No? Who is that? Who are they?
It is I, the Delegator, with my merry team of soups, known as the 14. Allow me to introduce them one by one. And might I add, you've done a very good job, but I will take over from here. Here I introduce Trailer Park.
Well, howdy doody, it's me, Trailer Park, and I got a possum tail, and I'm ready to whip those bad guys into shape. But not as bad as my good boy Icy Hot's gonna whip you. Icy Hot, what you got?
I'm cold when you need me to be and warm when you want to be.
This ain't the CW, but man, there's romance.
And here we have one of the strongest women on planet Earth, Tuberculosis Tammy.
I wish we were doing this in a drier climate. Don't worry, guys. He'll be coughing up blood in no time.
And here we have the only person on our team who wears diapers, Manchild.
Are you my mom or my girlfriend? Regardless, I have a month's worth of dirty laundry that needs to be folded.
Let's not ask why he folds his dirty laundry. And over here we have Fratiscat. Alpha Gamma Sigma for life. You may recognize the name, but trust me, he's very different. This is Tom Brady.
Hey, it's me, Tom Brady. I'm some other guy from Massachusetts that has a wicked strong arm, too. Anyway, let me kick it over to my other hero friend, Gazelle.
Ooh, ooh, ooh.
Yeah, you get him, Gazelle.
She doesn't talk very much, but they're very much in love. Check out their new romantic comedy hitting theaters this fall. And next to Gazelle, we have Top 10 Listinator.
Well, I have the top 10 reasons to kick your ass.
She's a real fierce one, that one. Check your sources. And straight off his debut on the Food Network, we have Rhubarb Randy.
I'm gonna poison you with my rhubarb poison pies. It's gonna give you a walloping.
And we have Rhubarb Randy's trusty sidekick in the kitchen and in fighting crime, Moonshiner.
Hey, what's up, everybody? I got a 200 proof concoction that's gonna knock you off your feet, put you right in the ground. Drink this, Chuck E. Cheese.
And this next one's a strong lady, no ifs, ands, or buts about it. Lady Suppository.
Let me tell you, we're gonna stop this villain, and here's my plan. Oh! Oh, that's cold.
And then our very slippery son of a bitch, Slime Warp. I'm just gonna over there, and I'm gonna over there, and I'm gonna over there, and then they're dead. And on loan from the O Network, we have Dr. Oz.
So all you have to do is stick this medical device right up your nose and you yourself can be super.
I'm telling you, Dr. Oz, it didn't work.
Lady Suppository, that's your problem.
It looks like these heroes have it covered. Now, back to our other programming.
Well, I hope those heroes have it covered. I'm not too sure with all those powers, but they got a lot going on. Anyway, we're back with another episode of Son of a Ginger. As always, I'm Patrick Baylor.
I'm Mason Moreau.
And I'm Beth Marcingo.
And we're talking The Boys, an Amazon original series. Came out earlier in the summer. And Vought International, they brought some cool superheroes. Maybe not as cool as the ones we just came up with. But we got a fun series about superheroes. Haven't heard about that before.
There have been plenty of series about superheroes prior to this show, but I don't think there have been any quite like this one. The show generated a lot of buzz right off the bat. I remember seeing it sort of advertised everywhere and being like, what is this? Like a graffiti drawing of Superman? And there was sort of a general intrigue about the show. And then when the conversation around it started growing and growing, it almost seemed like a no-brainer to just dive in and start watching, for sure, right?
It was just such a more fun, I guess, poignant take on the superhero thing of that we see hammered over and over and over and over again by CW and
Marvel TV and Marvel Netflix TV, and just like there's so many damn superhero shows. And Mason, when you told me about this show when it came out in the summer, I was great. Another one. Sure, I'll check it out, bro. And then you continue to tell me how good it was. And what a surprise. So you'd think this is a show from DC. Looks like a very DC group, but it's made from Dynamite Entertainment, created by Garth Ennis and Derek Robertson, developed from their own comics, The Boys. And a very original vision, I think, that spun well the tried and true superhero thing that we've seen for decades. And so the concept of these comics and now this show, it focuses on a group of heroes that they're essentially the Justice League. They have all these powers that we have seen in all these other comics. And it's a quick look behind their heroism. It's like, oh, everyone is terrible. They're abusive or alcoholics or predatory or just general perverts. And then we see these terrible people then affect a mild-mannered dude. Their Flash character, A-Train, runs into his fiance and he's left to pick up the pieces with Vought International, who's this company that runs these heroes. They give him like a measly settlement. It's not enough. And then we go into this conspiracy to bring down the Seven with a band of heroes and anti-heroes, I'd say. Carl Urban and Jack Quaid, Dennis Quaid's little baby son.
Yeah. There's never really anyone in this show who is truly 100% good.
No.
Mm-mm. Yeah, I would totally agree with that.
Yeah, I think that this show, what initially made it stand out to me was it approaches this tried and true sort of concept of a team of superheroes in our world, right? With just the right amount of cynicism to make it original again, right? What would happen if Superman and the Justice League really existed in our world?
Yeah.
They'd be overcome with celebrity, right? Mm-hmm. They'd be completely above the law. They'd be operating basically freely, right? They wouldn't be 100% good. They wouldn't be curly-haired dream people that we sort of drum up in comics and movies.
They would be very vain.
They would be very vain.
Right. Well, and as we learn, they're only human. They just have this extra compound pumped into them. So they have all of the terrible tendencies that humans have. They just have this kind of absolute power to control their surroundings, and it corrupts them. Like it would anybody.
Yeah, so like the human element of it that we see, yeah, just the ego of it all. Just see them, like with the Deep, for example, played by Chase Crawford. The minute that dropped, literally, when he dropped his pants, that's when I knew what this show was. It's like, oh, this is not your classic superhero thing. It's going to get dark. It's going to get uncomfortable. And I couldn't tell you how many times I felt uncomfortable with the show. And just seeing the terrible humanness of it all. And the Deep was one of them, the Aquaman character, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Well, and so the Deep is such an uncomfortable character throughout the entire season. He is very complex in the fact that we first see him as this creepy, horrible assaulter, and then he becomes a victim of assault. And we see his complex personal journey, and it's very hard to grapple with seeing somebody who is an abuser become a victim, and it's hard to know how to feel about him. But we also see him struggle with his professional life, where nobody takes him seriously. That's the traditional Aquaman trope that, oh, he just talks to fish. Whatever, fine. Where the Aquaman character who can communicate with creatures that cover 70% of the world, that's incredible. But everyone's just like, oh, he's a fish boy. So the fact that he gets sent to Sandusky, Ohio, I also think was a very poignant piece to put in there. You remember the Sandusky scandal?
Yeah, Jerry Sandusky.
Yeah.
I didn't pick up on that originally.
I don't know if it was intentional, but it seemed intentional to me.
So yeah, with like a little Easter egg like that, and then just how this was all written in general, I felt every minute and every part of this was poignant and had a point. It just wanted to keep hitting you with the absurdities and the hypocrisy that we see in the world right now. And especially just using these heroes and showing that they're not heroes. I think they were very successful. So we talk about the Deep, but we have this cavalcade of other characters. Let's talk about Homelander, who just let a burning plane drop in the sky and said, it's not worth the PR crisis, right, Maeve?
That was one of the hardest scenes to watch.
For sure. It was a very, very grueling scene. But I think that the magic that this show really, really captures is the way that it very, very smartly extrapolates upon the what if, the initial what if scenario, right?
Yeah.
You sit down and you're going to write a story about superheroes and you want it to be completely different. It's like, what if superheroes were this way? What if Robert Downey Jr. in his drugged out days was actually Iron Man also? And was a Hollywood film actor and all of these things. Like, how, what would that look like? And then it goes into sort of like satire of the military industrial complex and then satire of fame itself. It's this crazy, awesome piece of satire that's no holds barred. And in this sort of post Avengers Endgame climate, it's the perfect thing to be like, oh, you know, just when you thought you had enough superheroes, like this thing comes along and proves to you that like it can still be done.
And that's why this, I think, was such a breath of fresh air. Because here's the thing, I've said it before, it's hard for me to watch dramas, but this is a drama with a sci-fi ting that made me more interested. And that it's now like, yeah, just shit talking the government here or just making fun of some other thing there, like it made the oversaturation of the superhero market finally navigable, in my opinion.
Well, and it's interesting that you say like oversaturation, because I think there's an oversaturation of the military industrial complex as well. I think all of these things that Mason said that the writers are bringing together here, it's all about excess. Everything is about excess, whether that's ultimately power of some kind or fame or control. I guess that's another form of power, but it's all about grappling with all of this excess. And I think Homelander personifies that the most. He has the most powers other than Annie that we've seen so far, although we haven't seen them go head to head yet. So I guess we'll find out. Hopefully.
Yet.
Right. So I have a question for you guys. They're called the Seven, right? And we talk about all of their sort of vices. Do you think that each one of them might represent the seven deadly sins?
Yeah, probably.
Well, all right, Mason. Well, let me just pull up my list here. All right. So we have pride. We have envy. We have gluttony. We have lust, anger or wrath, greed, and sloth. Who do you say pride would be?
Homelander.
Homelander's pride. All right. Envy.
Or Queen Maeve.
That could
be true. I think Queen Maeve is like, because she's too prideful to be open about her sexuality, like that kind of thing.
That's true.
Yeah. I think she's pride.
That makes a lot more sense. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
There's envy. I could see that being the deep, honestly.
No, I think the deep is lust.
You think so?
I thought maybe translucent could be that, because he's nude all the time. He's always like creeping.
He's just a perv.
That's true.
Yeah, translucent. Big perv.
Goodness.
So which one is Homelander?
So
greed, maybe then?
Maybe greed.
I mean, there's straight up anger.
Oh, isn't it wrath? Oh, yeah. Homelander is wrath.
Sloth. It's definitely black noir because he just plays the piano now and then and doesn't really do anything. So black noir is sloth.
And black noir is kind of my favorite of the seven.
It's totally my favorite.
Do you think, I don't know, could Annie become wrath if we're talking about the seven in this way?
I can see Annie being envy, to be honest. She sees like the heroes and, you know, she's pushed in it, I guess. She's the most redeemable, literally, of all of the seven.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, A-Train, though. A-Train has got to be greed or gluttony. Pride.
Oh. No, yeah, gluttony, definitely.
Oh, he's gluttony. Yeah, he loves that compound V.
Yeah, so.
Did we get to all of them?
We'll be Homelander, Wrath, Starlight.
Envy.
Envy. Black Noir, Sloth.
A-Train, Gluttony.
Pride, Queen Maeve.
Lust was translucent. Then Greed.
Is the deep?
Is it the deep?
I guess he's greedy for more attention and for more power.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
I guess in a sense, the deep could be just greedy for the attention that his powers have afforded him, I guess.
Mm-hmm. I think that that makes sense. It might be an imperfect comparison, but I really like the idea of making that type of connection.
It seems so deliberate, though, right? You call these people the seven. They're supposed to represent like things that are evil. What do you think about seven things that are the representation of evil, the seven deadly sins?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they're he just called them the seven because that's what he drew from and didn't really associate a sin to each person. Like, it wasn't that deep. But The writer of this comic also wrote Preacher, which is the other Seth Rogen, Evan Goldberg executive produced show.
So all of the stuff from this guy, Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg just read their comics as a kid possibly, and then we're like, let's just make this now that we have the money to. Yay!
Well, I think both of these have a sort of satirical lens that are lended to popular formats, right? So it's very much like watching something Tarantino makes, or where it's a specific artist's vision realized in similar beats and similar flavors, right? So Garth Ennis is writer's name, creator of Preacher and The Boys comic series. I really want to just like dive in and start reading his stuff now, because I definitely want to compare the show to the comic itself, similar to how people did that with The Walking Dead. I think in terms of the next big comic book adaptation show, this is certainly it. Similar to The Walking Dead. I don't know how they compare in terms of ratings and viewership, but I haven't been this jazzed about a comic book show since The Walking Dead.
Yeah, and I think what I'm enjoying about this one, and then I guess now I want to check out Preacher, based on what you said, because it has this clear creative vision, you know, by Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg, but also with this one, let's not forget about Eric Kripke, who, you know, got famous doing Supernatural and already doing the niche kind of TV. And this premiered at like New York Comic Con, I believe, last year. At least that's when this first started getting shown and appropriately. And this is something that I hope that fans will really latch onto and really develop a growing fan base like we can think of The Walking Dead has in the 21st century, you know, of just original comic IP. We talk about all these heroes, air quotes. Let's talk about the anti-heroes. Let's talk about the boys themselves. We got Carl Urban, who has been to many a Comic Con. And then little Huey, played by Jack Quaid. Were these guys a little bit more redeemable? It seems like everyone has problems in this show.
So let's unpack what makes this dichotomy, this comparison between the Seven and the Boys, such a compelling arc. The Boys, each one of them has almost your completely stereotypical supervillain backstory, but they're the protagonists of the show, right? And the antagonists are what you would traditionally consider the protagonists, right? Mm-hmm. So they already have this sort of yin-yang, this is the other side of the coin, flavor to it, right?
Yeah.
And I think it teaches you a lot about creating compelling backstories for your characters, right? Because Captain America Civil War, one of my favorite villains in the MCU is Zemo, because he's just a person who was distraught by the actions of the heroes. And he decided to destroy them from within because he was compelled to, because they killed his family, right?
Yeah.
And that to me was one of the best villain backstories, because it was so relatable and so deeply rooted in something that an audience can understand, right? And so through that, you sort of learn that it doesn't have to be the villain's backstory. It can be the hero's backstory. The backstory itself is universal. It's not about your antagonist or your protagonist. And I think that's what it taught me personally, is that a compelling backstory is a compelling backstory.
I think that we can all agree that the character writing in this is great.
Fantastic.
I would say that the dialogue and some of the plot points are a little forced or a little exposition heavy. The middle episodes, I did not think were as strong as the first two or three, or as strong as maybe like the last one or two.
I think still important though, because it's season one of a brand new show. I don't know who any of these characters are. With the church thing, for example, because also I enjoyed that episode because it was, again, a satire of just the American religious culture that we live in. The fact that we got to like maybe dip into just a little bottle episode here and there just to better understand the world, I didn't mind that.
With the quality of television that's on now, sometimes weak episodes like that can kill somebody's watching of it. I did think that because I was watching it critically, maybe I have a different view than just somebody who's watching it for fun, just for the story, because I definitely do that with certain things. But at the beginning, I felt like the prison guard character, Mother's Milk, was purely there for exposition purposes so that we could find out who Mallory was, so that we could find out about Butcher's wife and all of these other things that are ultimately essential to know for the backstory, but that didn't necessarily come as naturally as I felt like some of the other story points did. He was a very exposition-heavy character, but still well thought out.
We've knocked exposition on this show before if it's too shoehorned in. This was shoehorned in a polite way to where it helped me as the viewer better understand the definition of exposition.
Sure. And that's fine. I think that being a little more exposition heavy in certain episodes made those episodes slightly weaker than others.
But on the flip side, you don't want to take every episode and insert some unnatural exposition, because for every exposition heavy episode, we'll get one that's like central to just that story going and chugging ahead. But then we'll have another episode that kind of balances it out and you get the full picture after seeing the whole season.
Sure. But does it have to be one or the other? Like, I think really good writing could balance those. And I think that the writing overall is pretty good. There's just definitely dialogue in this, especially in those couple of middle episodes, that felt very forced to me.
I definitely felt like a lot of times that the show got a little ham-fisted and campy. But I always felt like because it did that for the sake of dark comedy, for the sake of it being this hilariously absurd situation that kind of would happen in this universe, but you really don't have like an incredible amount of context for how that would actually play out in real life. For instance, like the track meet between the two speedsters, right? Most of it, I guess, is with A-Train.
I think that was some helpful exposition because we had the news reporters. We're going to find out who the fastest man in the world is. And then to better understand A-Train's character, oh, he's someone that's so insecure about his own powers. Everyone's unsure if they're going to be in the seven tomorrow because they messed up on something. But we get to see that purely through his, because if I lose this race, that means I'm not going to be good enough. And oh, what does this mean? What does that mean? And it like informs more of what I think he's thinking inside. And we understand A-Train a little bit more. So with the super exposition of the race scene, that helped me get to know A-Train.
Yeah, so basically I thought like the beginning of the over-exposition started in episode 4. There was a lot of action. That is the episode where Homelander and Queen Maeve had to leave the plane. That was very heavy to deal with. But the scene in the train station, I thought that when Butcher was giving the Spice Girls speech, and kind of before the exposition before and around that, I just felt like it was weaker overall than some of the other episodes we got, even though there was this major action.
I can understand where you're coming from. As much as it's important for character development and this and that and this, maybe it doesn't need to be thrown at you and just, hey, here's the part that you need to understand the rest of the series. Anyway, let's continue the story. Yeah, I understand what you're saying.
Mm-hmm. I did ultimately think, though, that the exposition about Becca ended up being very good because her story was such a driving force and not even a red herring, but
it's a bait and switch.
Yeah, exactly. And I actually, before they did the reveal, was like, oh, like, what if she is alive? Like, what if I thought that Vought was hiding her? That was my initial thought when we found out that she could be alive. I really enjoyed getting those tidbits about her because I felt like that drove my interest forward.
Yeah, and all those little bits of information, those tidbits were helpful to understand the series as a whole. And this did so much in only 8 hours. This accomplished a lot.
Mm-hmm. The big burning question of the show is, why is Butcher so angry? Huey is having second thoughts about what they're doing, and he watched his girlfriend explode in front of him.
And that was devastating.
Why is Butcher so angry? And so, you know, watching the show, that's the whole thing. And they give you breadcrumbs, right? And then you mm-hmm. find out, oh, she had an affair with Homelander. Oh, she got pregnant with Homelander's child. Oh, Homelander's. And it all builds up to the final shot of the series, which I feel is going to kick off a very, very good second season. Speaking of second season,
it's already been announced. Yes, that is a sequel or a second season, you smell. It was announced like I think a day or a week before season one premiered. They were ready to tell a story. I'm ready to see more of the story. So to talk about the next parts, who from the seven is intact? Translucent's been dead. The Deep is still in Ohio.
Yeah, the Deep is transferred. He was demoted.
The Deep, though, in the second season, will find a way to weasel out of there and get back in the ocean.
I think the Deep is going to become much more of an ally character throughout the arc of the show. I think that they introduced him as being in one point in his life, and throughout this whole first season, he learned a lot of hard lessons. And I think these hard lessons are going to start changing his character a little bit to where he'll approach Starlight and apologize profusely and maybe sort of become an ally to the boys or have sort of more of a rogue presence where he's not with the boys or with the Seven. He's kind of in the middle.
He's kind of like Catwoman.
I could see him being that kind of maverick character that's like out on his own, doing his own vigilante type thing and probably screwing up a lot of other plans in the process because he's dumb and doesn't have a lot of information.
Yeah.
He doesn't. I wouldn't say, I guess, that he's dumb. He just does not possess a lot of forethought.
But also, the Deep sort of existed to be a B-plot or C-plot character, and we learned about him and his character as kind of this other thing while the main stuff happens. So we talk about all this stuff. I think Homelander might have some sort of new role given that he didn't kill Butcher's wife, that he's been like secretly fathering this family.
No, he didn't know.
No, he didn't know about them either.
He didn't know they existed until he
squeezed the information from the scientist.
Oh.
Yeah, he didn't know they existed until right around Butcher did.
Okay, so Homelander has a son, so does this make him care more? Does this make him want to redeem himself anymore?
No, it's another person to compete with him.
I think Homelander is irredeemable at this point. The idea that he has a son is just going to be that he's now raising this little maniac. He's going to be teaching this kid what he knows about life. There's going to be that tug of war of the son's mom knows what's right, but she can't do anything about it because she's just a human. And so there's going to be that drama there where this horrible father is raising her son incorrectly and she has nothing to do about it. And in the event that she comes out on top using her wit, that is a very strong character moment.
All I hope is that Homelander's kid doesn't have the same weird mommy issues that Homelander has with Elizabeth Shue's character throughout the series, because that was uncomfortable, of all the many uncomfortable moments.
I loved that, though. The point they try to drive home is that these heroes, while they are very evil and irreprehensible human beings, they're also grossly misunderstood.
If we were talking about normal fame, like normal famous people, you know, can barely go anywhere without being crowded by a bunch of people. But imagine having these extra powers where somebody expects you to be your best all the time. And that's kind of what we expect from famous people, to be nice and to be funny and to always have a good day and a smile on their face and to greet you, their fan, as somebody who supports them and who they like. And that's just not always the case. And I think it's just taken to that extra extreme with these superheroes.
These superheroes, they're people too. But the other people that they wrong, they're also people. So I'm still rooting for Huey and Butcher and Mother's Milk and Frenchie and the rest of the crew, because I learned to love these classic supervillain stories that show that, oh, these guys are actually much nicer than you paint them to be.
I'm done with Starlight. I like cannot wait to see what she does next.
Yeah, we lump Starlight in the Seven. Starlight, I think, is great.
Great character.
Lovely lady. Lovely gal.
You know, she's sort of the audience's window into the world of the Seven, right? She's the one that you latch onto immediately because she realized her potential, followed her dream, right? And it's that classic sort of character setup. She's great. And I like the relationship between her and Huey. And even if it was a little bit cookie cutter at times, right? You know, it's the, like, he's undercover, but he's in love with her. Like, that whole sort of deal that you see in, like, every cop drama about an undercover cop in the mob, or, like, you know what I mean? Like, it's totally plucked right out of that sort of storyline.
And then ends with the classic, you lied to me, what are you doing? But it's all for the right. Yeah, that was...
I don't even know you. I don't even think I know you anymore.
We've seen it before.
That sort of moment, that sort of cookie cutter moment, I guess, is what I was talking about, where I felt like the dialogue was weaker than it could have been. Because you do feel this betrayal, but is there maybe a better way to express that betrayal?
I understand you now, Beth.
Mm-hmm.
I understand you after all of these hours.
The power of conversation.
Before we go, I want to do a very, very quick game. So Translucent has been dead for a while now, and he has not been replaced. What superhero is going to take his place, and what superhero with their crazy fun name and their even crazier insecurity is going to take his place? I don't think it's anyone from that C-list that tried to save the day earlier on. I think we need someone new, someone fresh, someone that can save the day.
concave, and he inflates 40 times the size of his body. But he's called concave instead of convex.
He's what? Just a lens.
Yeah.
And what is concave's insecurity?
He struggles with body image.
And overeating.
He struggles with body dysmorphia. Beth, what would be your ideal hero to replace Translucent?
I'd have to go with Invisalign.
Oh.
And along the same lines of Mason, Invisalign's insecurity is definitely their image, their teeth.
But at the same time, his power is charisma.
Yes,
and
yeah.
His smile can convince people to do things and influence them.
He's also like just very sparkly.
Okay. He appears in a lot of infomercials.
Oh, 100%. He's on at 3 in the morning on Game Show Network like no other.
Yeah, definitely some MTV, like proactive commercials.
His main demographic is tweens. Yes. And young teens who are also insecure. Invisalign draws his power from the insecurity of these teenagers.
See, I would just like to see the next hero be Elizabeth Shue, played by Elizabeth Shue, who's also already in the show. But she's just a big animatronic shoe, and she steps out all the villainy. Elizabeth the Shoe, and guess what her insecurity is? Stinky feet!
One of these days, these shoes are going to walk all over you.
That's her walk-in music.
Reminds me of that Rick and Morty episode where they have like the fake SNL cast. They're like, piece of toast, and skaharmanarnar.
I mean, hell, we did that all of earlier this morning.
Earlier today.
It feels like this morning because we've been talking your ears off. But if you have the power of good listening, listen to our past podcast wherever you get your podcast.
And be our hero and leave us a 5-star review.
Oh, yeah. And maybe even follow us, like any follower of Homelander, but on our social, at Son of a Ginger Podcast, on Instagram. Otherwise, I've been the heroic Patrick Baylor.
I've been the villainous Mason Moreau.
And I've been the skeptical Beth Marcinko.
And the Son of a Ginger, blast off!